There's a question on the true Dharma in these conversations that I've been having about where, what are the sources, and the sources are the Sutta. It's Sutta, yeah?
Sutta.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
But it's kind of the classic text, and there's a lot of resources available, books, etc.
Yes.
Which expound Dharma as well.
Yeah.
Would you have any guidance on that, as we're studying?
Oh, okay. I mean, of course, the greatest source is the Buddha himself. Our own kind of tradition is grounded in the, say, like Ajahn Chah and Lumpa Samedo and the other forest traditions. But you know, even in a contemporary sense, all of the teachers, draw on many different sources, and a lot of it is having that kind of discernment as to what lines up with the principles that are, I mean, it's kind of like what comes to mind is when Ajahn Chah was in America, and Paul Breiter, a former monk, wore Banyo. He had left the robes a couple years before that and had been in America studying mostly Zen at that point, but also, different teachings and getting exposed to all sorts of... He went to the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, so he was exposed to all sorts of teachings. And then him talking with Lumpa Cha and saying, that his, he had a friend of his who wasn't so keen on formal meditation or formal practice, but he was really keen on putting it into, sports and rock climbing. When he was, rock climbing, he felt really completely alive and present and in the present moment, and so Paul asking Ajahn Chah, well, can this be practiced as well? And Lumpa he burst out laughing and said, only a Farang and think that climbing rocks is going to be going to be a way to enlightenment. But then he said, is he contemplating the Four Noble Truths when he's climbing rocks? So, that's a really good standard of what's the mind inclining to. Whatever we're doing, whether we're reading or studying or listening to different teachings, does it help us incline to the dukkha and the ending of dukkha?
Yeah, I'd say one of the there's so much material around and about these days, and oftentimes, particularly on the web, you get quotations like, the Buddha said, and it's good to check, well, did he? Because often there's tags are on there, but it's kind of a dubious translation, or not even a translation. It's a sort of a copy of a copy of a copy of someone's right idea. So that, in a way, applying your own wise reflection is important. And so if you come across some teachings and it seems to make sense. Also, part of it is that it doesn't just say things that fit our opinions and our desires. But there's elements in there that challenge our own habits and self-centered ways of thinking, and so that it's not just gratifying our own views out of saying, "Oh, I like this; this agrees with me." But there's a kind of challenge and a drawing upon an intuitive sense of, "Well, that's demanding, but somehow that feels like it's a good direction to go." And there's a beautiful set of of teachings that the Buddha gave as advice to his foster mother, who became who was his aunt, who became his sort of his surrogate mother when he was growing up, and she was the first nun, Mahaprajapati Gotami. And these eight pieces of advice that he gave her, which she said, how do you know what is the good Dhamma, what is not the good Dhamma? And that's a really excellent collection. I cannot recite them off the top of my head. But Ajahn Pasano is reaching for his phone.
Well, that's the one thing I can do.
Because
I can't recite them off the top of my head, but I'm surprised.
The eight pieces of advice to go to me. And it's a kind of a very practical set of measures, things that incline towards simplicity rather than complication, towards relinquishment rather than accumulation. So it's very tangible, and it's a sort of eight criteria that you can sort of bear in mind and say, well, this teaching is impressive, or it's powerful, or it's poetic, or appealing. Does it meet these criteria? So that's a handy measure. The Book of the Eights.
Yeah, Book of the Eights, Sutta number 53. so that those qualities that lead to... Yeah, you can look at it. And it might be handy to have the alternate translation. Because I've got Ajahn Jeff's here, so there's some. That's oftentimes a good way of getting a good feel for the terminology. So those qualities leading to dispassion, not to passion, to being unfettered, not to being fettered, to shedding, not to accumulating, to modesty, not to self-aggrandizement, to contentment, not to discontent, to seclusion, not to entanglement, to arouse persistence, not to laziness, to being unburdensome, not to being burdensome. If you have these, you may categorically hold, this is the Dhamma, this is the Vinaya, this is the teacher's instruction.
It's very, very, very close.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sutta 53 in the Book of the Eights. And it was also, it's kind of touching that it's the Mahaprajapati, who was the first nun and who was his mother for most of his childhood, so asking for advice. This is the advice he's giving her as a sort of framework for understanding what is the teaching, what is the training. Because a number of the elements are to do with lifestyle and the way you relate to material resources and such like, because she was a queen before she was a nun, so she came from a luxurious lifestyle. So things like leading to solitude, not to being in company, leading to being easy to support, not difficult to support. If you've been a queen, you're rather used to having large supplies of everything that might be convenient and delightful, but it's inclining towards being easy to support and having fewness of needs and such like.